It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Liz. So happy you're here. I was thinking about February and March, and because I'm a parent, they mean so much more than the end of winter and the start of spring, right? It's also college acceptance letter season. So many kids today have it ingrained in their heads that where you go to college determines how your future will unfold. That if you don't get into an Ivy League school or your first choice of school, you're somehow doomed. Well, let my guest today totally prove that wrong. He was rejected by his first and only choice, an Ivy League school, Princeton. The hard work and time he put in to get accepted was all for nothing. And because he put all his eggs in one basket, he found himself at high school graduation with nowhere to attend university. But that's when the fight kicked in. The kid whose first job was at age 6 selling newspapers at a subway stop just south of Harlem fired up his tenacity. Not only did he end up at a great university in the Midwest, he grew to become one of the top venture capitalists in the world. Here to talk about how he turned his stumbling blocks into stepping stones is Alan Patricoff. What a list of companies he's either founded or co-founded. Apex, Graycroft, and now Prime Time Partners. Alan, thank you so much for being here and joining us. What a great story. And I can't wait for our Everyone Talks to Liz listeners to hear it. How are you?
I'm great. I'm very excited about my new business, Primetime Partners, which I started at age 85, which is a little unusual.
I would say you just take a licking and keep on kicking, although you really haven't been hit at the knees too much throughout your career because you just almost chose not to notice any walls that came up. But that's what I want our listeners to hear, your climb. But let's go back to your childhood in New York City, son of Russian immigrants.
Yes, my father came over from Smila, which was a small town outside of Kyiv, in 1907, in steerage, of course. And my mother came over sometime in 1910 or something like that from Belarus. I don't know exactly what town. And started out with absolutely nothing and didn't leave me too much in the way of financial resources. So I had to do most of my climbing on my own.
6 years old, your first gig, and that was hawking newspapers, right?
I think my father just sent me out and said, you know, go find out what it's like to earn a buck.
And so tell me about that as best you can remember.
God, you're asking me to remember a long time ago, but I actually have a vision of my standing next to the subway on 103rd Street in New York City with one of the, at that time you'd have a bag around your neck, mm-hmm. which hung, and you had these, I sold Saturday Evening Post, to be exact, for 5 cents at the time. So it was the beginning of my long career.
Can you imagine a six-year-old out on the street selling papers today? We really should have that in America so people get the sense, although I know there are a lot of child labor laws, but a sense of bootstrapping and getting out there and really realizing what a hard day's work means.
Well, my father had a very tough growing up. For him to do something like that was like his childhood had been in the Midwest in Middletown, Ohio.
You know, back of course, to you mentioned Kyiv, which then was all part of Russia, of course, today Ukraine. My ancestors came from Odessa, which used to be Russia and is now, of course, Ukraine. So that immigrant spirit, what do you feel that you really gleaned from it as you then forged ahead as a teenager and then an adult?
I think the major thing I got from my father and somewhat to my mother is they were Depression people who lived and knew what it was like not to have very much. And I always remember my father never had a credit card. Not that in those days, there weren't credit cards until Diners Club came in. I don't remember what year that was. But he believed if you couldn't buy something for cash, he wouldn't buy it. So he lived he just did not believe in debt. So he had no He didn't leave me any financial obligations to take care of for him.
Let's get you to high school where you had your sights on Princeton.
Yeah, well, I went to a school. My parents, over the years, took education as being much more important than anything else, and they sacrificed a great deal to get my sister and I to to decent private schools, which was very inexpensive in those days. Mm-hmm. And when I went to Horace Mann, it was the kind of school that everybody went to an Ivy League school. They went to, you know, Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, or Amherst, or Williams. You just go down the line. And so it was almost taken for granted. And I had my heart set on Princeton. I had applied to a couple of other schools that I turned down because I was on the waiting list for Princeton. And then in June, I didn't get into Princeton. And here I was graduating from this fancy private school and having no college. So I had to start applying right then. And I applied to four schools in June, which is pretty late, and actually got into all four of them. It was Columbia, Penn, Brandeis, and Ohio State. And I was going to go to Brandeis. And I had been accepted. I was accepted all four. And I went to a formation meeting in New York. And it was very early on in Brandeis. And it was, when I walked into the room, it was a very, very religious group that mm-hmm. was there at the time.
Jewish.
Which made me nervous that I was going into something I wasn't prepared for. So I turned around and came home that night and pasted the label for Ohio State over the label for Brandeis because my father had gone a year or two to Ohio State. He had emigrated to Ohio. And I had no idea what it was like. I had never been there and went to a new environment. And that was, I actually graduated in 3 years because at least the Horace Mann credits were advanced. I had enough AP that I could accelerate, and I graduated in 3 years.
So you became a Buckeye. I found that fabulous because I spent 7.5 years in Ohio doing local news in Columbus, 3.5 years
oh, wow.
of it, and then Cleveland. And I love Ohio. And me, an L.A. girl, you would think.
I wrote for the Columbus Citizen while I was at Ohio State.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So you were a little journalist yourself there. But, you know, what do you glean from that moment where you realized, I'm left with no college. I've got to kick into gear. What was it within you that got you moving? And can you somehow articulate why people should not completely collapse when something unexpected happens that isn't exactly what you think is good?
Well, I think that I was quite upset about not going where I wanted.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed to the extent that I just wanted to get away. And that's why I didn't go to Columbia or Penn. I didn't want to be around all the people I knew from Horace Mann. I was pretty depressed at the moment. Brandeis, I would have been the only one going there. But I went to Ohio State. I think I'm the only one who went to Ohio State from any place in those days. And, I'm just a resilient person. I don't give up very easily.
And that path led you somewhere where you might not have actually gone had you attended Princeton. Do you ever look at it like that?
No, I don't. Well, it's very possible. I never thought about it, but my father was a stockbroker, and so I always had kind of followed the market. So I had an interest in the market, and it seemed like to me the natural place to go. I had a couple of job offers that would have landed me in the Midwest, one in Moline, Illinois with Caterpillar, and the other one with the National Bank of Detroit. I can't now, today, 50 or 60 years later, envision myself living there or living any place but New York. So, everything, I have no complaints the way things worked out.
Don't you feel that everything really does happen for a reason?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I go to a reunion, crazy. We have a reunion for our class in Horace Mann there aren't that many people who attend. I think we're down to about 8. We never were more than 12 or 13. And we have lunches every 3 or 4 months. And I must say I have to smile because when I go, because they usually set the lunch up near my office since I'm the only one that's still working. I'm the only one that doesn't have hearing aids. I'm the only one that doesn't have a walker or a cane. So whatever I've done, and I think I've done relatively well compared to the others.
Oh, yeah. And some of them, I'm sure, did do the Ivy League dance.
They all did.
They all did. Exactly. So there, we've got that message out. I want to talk about the generation that you came from and how back then there really weren't a ton of venture capitalists.
No, the story of my getting my first job is an interesting one. When I came to New York, I didn't have a job. Just like I didn't have a college, I didn't have a job. There were no recruiters, certainly at Ohio State. I don't know if there were any place then. Today, there are hundreds of them that visit the campuses to try to get graduates to join their firm. So I didn't have, you know, access to the Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or anyone else at that time. So I had to really wear out shoe leather, as they say. I came to New York and I decided to work on Wall Street. So if you want to work on Wall Street, I went to Wall Street and I started out at like 120 Wall Street or 130 Wall Street at the bottom near the East River and went into every building, went up the elevator to the top floor, and then walked down the stairs, because in those days there weren't security in every building. There was no security. It was free and easy. Exactly. It was very much easier. And I'd go to every floor to a receptionist and say, are there any jobs available? And it took me about 3 or 4 months, and I got to 63 Wall Street, and that's where I got my job, from the top floor, I must say, of that building.
And, okay, so 3 and 4 months, you never gave up. Did you feel a little bit sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, demoralized?
No, I never was discouraged. I mean, Wall Street's very long. if I only got to 63, I mean, I had all the way to 1. Where, by the way, years later, I ended up at 2 Wall Street at another job, so afterwards. So I started out at 63 and
And the job at 63 Wall Street, what was that?
It was a very, very elegant, prestigious investment counseling firm. And frankly, I'll never know why they took me, because they were the partner, senior partner was had been the senior economist at Goldman Sachs, and the other two partners had come from a very prominent Wall Street firms, and they had all gone to Yale or Harvard, and for some reason, the receptionist got me an appointment, and an old-fashioned Yale-y interviewed me, and I was hired as a junior analyst, and it all, you know, started there, and I started in a great place, and if you start out well, you can parlay that into subsequent positions that, you know, build on that reputation.
Sure. Persistence, certainly. But I want to fast forward to where you began to realize there was a real opportunity to take capital and invest in companies that were starting up and not necessarily a sure thing.
No, that happened in my fourth job. It sounds like a lot, but it wasn't that much. I was at this position for 7 or 8 years, actually. It was a family office. And I was one of the senior people there, not running it. And the senior partner was always being approached by one of the titans of Wall Street, names which were, at those days, were very household names for, you know, people like Andre Meyer from Lazard, Gus Levy from Goldman Sachs, all the famous people would call up the senior partner I worked for and offer them a position in some new company they were financing. And traditionally, the family offices invested only in well-known stocks of the New York Stock Exchange. But over time, they would accumulate these certificates and investments in companies they knew nothing about. So they spent all their time analyzing major companies, and they'd put the stock certificates in a drawer or the paperwork related to it. And I was the only person in the company who was interested in these odd companies. And during this period of time, which were in the 60s, one of the things we looked at was New York Magazine. And I was the one who did the analysis, mm-hmm. was the person who was involved in it, became very deeply involved in it, and subsequently became chairman of the board of the company. And at the same time, I started a medical electronics company, backed one, and a company in the TV radio business called Lynn Broadcasting. And all those companies have subsequently been bought and sold many times.
This is Everyone Talks to Liz, and we'll be right back.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Klayman. Just go to Indeed.com/Klayman right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Klayman. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I want our listeners to know about a company that came on your radar called Apple.
I don't even think there was officially a venture capital industry at that time. It was just investing in deals. Mm-hmm. And it became, you might say, an industry in the 70s when it is the National Venture Capital Association was formed in like 74 or so. Apple was just another investment that we had, that we went into through the fund, and it came about through a relationship I had. I would like to say I was brilliant and found this, you know, isolated little invisible company, but it was very early. It had only been in business for a year or two. Mm-hmm. And someone I knew who was an investment banker called me up one day and said he had an opportunity to invest a small amount of money, to put together an investment of a small amount of money in this new early stage company.
But how'd they describe Apple to you at that point?
Well, I knew about it because I had, you know, one of the things, if you're in the venture business, you learn to see what trends are happening. Mm-hmm. And I had been very much aware of the beginnings of the personal computer market, which, you know, was Commodore Business Machines and Texas Instruments. And those were the earliest, and then Apple came on the scene, and there have been several articles about this new PC operation out in California. And so when the opportunity came up, I spoke with the management once over the phone, and we had a small fund at that time. We invested $315,000 in the company, and we ultimately being not that many years later, 3-4 years after they went public, we distributed the stock to our investors. So, you know, no one stayed for the full run. Although I had calculated in connection with my new book, No Red Lights, which you know that I just wrote, which tells a lot of these stories. While I was writing the book, I kept having a model developed so we could keep track of the price so I'd be accurate when the last draft was done. And it was a value of it would have been a value of $7 billion.
Oh, my God. Wait, so $315,000 would have become $7 billion?
Just shows you the value of compounding. And if you, exactly. If only I had stayed with that, I wouldn't have to do anything else. I wouldn't even be here today. But you never know. In the venture business, there are very, very, very rare situations when someone stays forever.
Right.
Because we're all in
funds. Well, they want to cash out. They also want to get their initial investment back.
Our funds have a terminal life to them. And the whole success of being in the venture business is to raise successive funds. In order to raise successive funds, you have to demonstrate some successes, and Apple was just one of many things that I sold along the way that I wish I held forever.
I bet. Well, throughout your time, you have made some very interesting investments. I want to talk about the RealReal, the resale website, which I am a huge fan of. I will now no longer buy full price, brand new retail designer bags because of the RealReal. Why bother? You get great stuff there. They vet it, and it's certainly a lot less expensive. What do you need to see in a company like that before you'll commit capital?
Well, you want to see management. I mean, it's always the same thing. It's always, I hate to make a cliched expression, but you always want to bet on the jockey, not the horse.
Hmm.
If you have a great jockey, if they pick the wrong idea and it's not working, they can pivot and do something else and reorient the capital. If you're betting on a product and it doesn't work, you've got a problem because there's no one else to lead the company to do something else. So in that case, it was a woman entrepreneur who was very talented and understood this business and had a
Julie Wainwright.
She had a good concept. She had a startup before that had not worked out,
mm-hmm.
Which is good because in our world, a prior failure is not a sign of death, it's a sign of experience.
Good.
As I understand it, I haven't seen her in a year or so, but I think she's now going on to start another company.
Mm-hmm.
She put together a team, and it's a very complicated process, what she does with the RealReal. I hope, do you sell to them as well as buy?
I'm too much of a hoarder. I can't let things go, but I think about it. And I will say this, that as you describe what you look for in a company, what do you look for when you're hiring people? We have listeners who would like to be hired out there for their passionate areas of interest. And, you know, sometimes they think to themselves, oh, I'm not a good candidate because I might not have experience in that particular area, even though I want to go into it, or B, I didn't go to a great school. What do you say to people like that?
Well, I say to them, I went to Ohio State.
Which is a great school, but
yes,
I mean,
but no, but it's not in the, I mean, I'm being very openly, mm-hmm. most people who are in the higher in the financial world did go to one of the Ivy League schools. And so I think there are plenty of exceptions around, but it is the exception. And but that college that you go to, once you pass the first job, no one's really looking at that intensely, frankly. And I don't know if are you speaking of getting a job or starting a company?
Let's talk about getting a job. Not all of our listeners are entrepreneurial in their ideas. We have many of them. But people who are looking for changing course midstream.
Honestly, I mean, it's a very hard thing to change course midstream. Let me explain it a different way. I think if you're a young person and you don't like the career you're in,
mm-hmm.
the best way to morph into another industry is to go to business school or go to some graduate school and come out of there and go to do something else. It's amazing how you can have that experience. Whereas if you're in the real estate business and you want to go in the investment business directly, it's hard to segue. Mm. So I think that's the one major advantage of going into a business school. But if you just traditionally want to get a job, I think you have to be smart and you have to have personality and you have to have a lot of patience. You have to kiss a lot of frogs, be prepared to be turned down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in a reasonably good environment today, even though you read about what's happening in the paper. Unemployment is pretty low, relatively. And the technology world certainly has opportunities. I think, you know, traditional companies are a great place to look at. I would bet that recruiting from General Motors or IBM has a very interesting approach today, which is, I forget the percentage, but there is a specific percentage which they call their SkillSoft or something like that, where they do not require college. They specifically have a program of hiring non-college people.
I love that.
I mean, it's a Gina Rometty is started. Started about, she says all the time that her husband complains that that people don't pronounce her last name properly.
I get Clamin instead of Clayman.
And she started this program because she saw there were a lot of talented people who didn't go to college.
So you've talked a lot about back then and at my age. How old are you?
88.
Okay. We just spoke to a guy who runs a cruise ship company, and a lot of elderly people are signing up for a 3-year cruise around the world because the cost of it, with food included and a doctor on staff 24 hours, is actually less than senior living care, which has gotten so expensive. That's where your passion lies now. You've become an investor in companies that focus on what you call prime time. Where are we heading in the graying of America?
Well, it's a field I'm very passionate about. And I am tired of reading about ageism, which starts at the top, our president, who, from every standpoint, if you watch what he's accomplished in the last year or two, it's pretty amazing in terms of legislation he's gotten through and initiatives. But you go across, and you go across the world, most world leaders are people over the age of 60 and even over the age of 70. I think we are headed now for a population growth in the over 60 market that will result by 2030 of more people over 60 than there are under 18. They say today, I mean, reliable sources, that half of the kids that are born today will live to be over 100. David Sinclair, who's one of the authorities in this aging area, has said, and I'm not going to support it, but I'm telling you what he said, and he's an authority, that there is someone alive today who will live to 150. The oldest person alive today, I think, is about 121. But the percentage of population is growing very fast. They're all born. The people are going to live longer. People are living longer. They have more money to spend. They're probably healthier because of exercise and biologics and pharmaceuticals that have kept people longer. And you can avoid a lot of the things that we couldn't avoid before in terms of serious diseases. So, and if you follow my belief, which in my book, No Red Lights, I say I'm going to live to 114. If anyone believes that and they're 60, they have half their life yet to live. And I started Primetime because of the fact that I saw a couple of people I knew who were being pushed into forced retirement at age 60 because their firm had a regulation. A lot of the law firms, a lot of the accounting firms, my original firm that I built, Apex, didn't refer to me, but has a rule that anyone over 60 has to leave.
That's just nuts. I don't like that.
At the prime of your life, when you've got the best Rolodex, when you know more people, when you have great skills in the
experience.
Field you're in.
Experience.
Yeah. And if you, as far as I believe, you can go back into the same business you were in, start all over again, or follow your passion. And you got an opportunity now with retirement and 401ks and Social Security. You've got ability to, and a nest egg perhaps you built up, you know, do something you've always wanted to do, you know, like become a doctor, become a lawyer, become a poet. So I think that the older age, the elderly market is a great opportunity for investment. And I think that older people should be thinking positively about what to do with the last half of their life.
You are such an inspiration. And for those of you listening, I've known Alan for quite some time now. But after I read his book, I said, oh, my God, I got to get him on, because what an incredible story that is far from over, far from over. Alan, thank you so much.
I have to think about chapter four, what I'm going to do next. I ran the marathon in November. I was the oldest person to finish the marathon.
Are you kidding? What was your time?
Well, the time at my stage, time is not important. It's the finishing that's important.
I know.
It was 8 hours, but
God bless you.
Yeah. And
was that your first marathon?
Oh, no. I ran it at very good times. But I was
back
at 47,
in the day.
I ran it at 3:31.
Whoa.
But those days I was running to be as fast as I could. Today, the objective is just to finish. I also went to Burning Man last year.
Oh, you are sizzling hot.
Well, I want to be an inspiration and tell people, you know, don't cash in your chips and go play golf in Florida. Do something interesting with your life.
You are an inspiration, and I thank you for sharing that with our listening audience. Thanks so much, Alan.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my God. Okay, so keep going, everybody. He says he's going to go to 114, and we hope it's longer. And for us, Monday through Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, you're going to need to protect and invest your money if you're going to go that long. That's what we try and help you do on the Claim and Countdown on Fox Business. I'll see you next time. Want to listen ad-free? You can do it with a Fox News Podcasts Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And then Amazon Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day. Featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.